You're listening to
Maine and Gray, the intersection of the city of God with the city of man, where we talk with interesting people doing interesting things out in God's world, and all for God's glory.
This episode is the pilot, in case you're
wondering. Oh, okay. At least it's not the rat.
The rat. Is that can you tell that story, or is it not appropriate?
Sure, I can tell.
Okay, that's fine. You can scrub it up if you
want
to.
So
how did your call sign was the rat?
So I was in the Navy, and naval aviators, if you've seen any of the Top Guns.
I mean, I've seen them. I really like them, but
they're very humble people, of course, right?
Very humble.
So call signs are given in the Navy generally to humble people. And of course, nobody goes into the Navy thinking their call sign is going to be Rat.
Yeah.
It's going to be Maverick or Iceman or something, right? So you get call signs based on either something you've done or play off your last name.
Preferably something embarrassing.
Something embarrassing or, you know, pseudo embarrassing to humble you, right?
Yeah, right.
A couple of examples. If your last name is Sharp, for example, you might be not so.
Right? Oh, okay.
Or Bright, not so bright. I had a very good friend of mine who ended up in an accident, and his call sign became Crash. But Rat. So, one of the things they teach you is don't show weakness. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you don't like something, don't say that you don't like something. And so they were trying different call signs on me, and mine, for some reason, they got Rat. And their some of the reasonings was, hey, you scurry around, you move with a purpose, you like cheese. And I was having none of it. I stopped answering to it, which just fed the flames.
Yeah.
And so I would come back from a flight, and there would be a big block of cheese in my mailbox.
Wow.
I'd have little rodents, little plastic rodents all over my chair. And so finally, an older pilot kind of put his arm around me and said, hey, look, this isn't going away. Just embrace it.
Yeah.
Become the rat.
And
you can have fun with it, right? He said, you could. When you're the flight lead of a flight, it's the rat flight, right? You can do all kinds of things. And so that's how the rat was born.
Yeah. I mean, there's the rat pack. There's some cool ways to do this.
There is. Exactly.
Yeah.
And there can be so many worse ones.
That's what I was thinking. There could be a whole lot worse than just the rat.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how I became the rat.
Yeah. Cool. Well,
yeah.
Do you have a favorite cheese? I mean, now that you said you like cheese,
I do like cheese.
Like cheddar.
I like kind of like smoked Gouda.
That's good.
Yeah.
So how did you end up as a career in the military? We're going to get into more details about the military and your work there, but just take us back to the beginning. Like, something you always dreamed to be as a kid, or just like, oh, this is a good career? What happened there?
So I have my maternal, on my mother's side, my grandfather, he was a gunner's mate, second class in World War II, on a minesweeper.
Oh, wow.
Fought in the Battle of Sicily.
Wow.
My dad was shortly in the military. But he had diabetes and had to be medically retired or resigned. But so there was a little bit of a tradition in my family. I got interested in the Navy early.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, I had a very good friend of mine who's still working for United Airlines now. He and I got into just private flying. And then, of course, Top Gun came out. So so it was kind of neat when I could see, hey, I could do Navy and fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my dream. So I began to pursue that, and eventually I got an appointment to the Naval Academy.
Mm.
I chose to not go crazy and become like an engineer and struggle with grades, because my goal was to be in the top quarter of the class so that I could guarantee a Navy pilot billet. And I was successful there as well.
Cool.
So, yeah, that's kind of how we kind of got into the military.
Yeah, so how many years in Annapolis? Is that four?
It's 4 years in Annapolis. I actually ended up having to go to an extra year of prep school to get in as well.
Sure, okay. That's cool. Yeah, so you were there, you studied to be a... Or Uncle Sam said...
This is hot, right?
It's hot, yeah. Good luck. Uncle Sam said you're going to be a pilot, but you didn't just... You didn't fly jets. You went the helicopter route.
Right.
Well, how does that happen? Because most of us don't know.
I mean,
most of us think, oh, you're an airline pilot, or aircraft, jet pilot, whatever. And then you switch over. But that wasn't the case for you?
So it's so the Navy... when you go through the Navy Training Command for aviation, we actually, it's not just Navy. It's Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, some allied nations as well come through our program. And all Navy pilots who go through the program do fixed wing flying first. And then from
fixed
there,
wing fixed wing being an airplane.
Being an airplane.
For those of us that don't know. Okay.
Yeah, fixed wing airplane.
Because of the helicopter, the wings.
Yeah, right. That's rotary wing.
Rotary wing.
Because they rotate, right? So so when you go through the called primary training, it's about 6 months or so. And then based on your grades and how you do, you then can go into several, we call them pipelines. It's the traditional jet pipeline, like becoming Maverick. Multi-engine fixed wing plane, kind of a maritime patrol, or you could go helicopters. Right, so there's kind of three major pipelines. There's a couple other little branches, but those are the big ones. So during primary training, I was on the road to being a jet pilot. Had the grades to be a jet pilot. Wanted to be a jet pilot. And God threw me my first little curveball, which was I got fairly airsick early on.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And airsickness is very humbling.
Is that common? Do you think that, do a lot of even, you know, fixed wing pilots end up with airsickness? They have to deal with it or get over it?
Right. And so that's what it is. It's just an adaptation of the body to it. And usually... It usually within about the first two or three, everybody like figures, okay, first couple of flights, you're going to have it. But mine continued all the way through my first 14 flights. And the 14th one is supposed to be a solo. And they're not going to let you solo an airplane if you're...
Yeah, you can't have a hand on a bag.
Right, yeah. So they paused my training, and I ended up doing what's colloquially known as spin and puke. Right, which is essentially you go into a chair.
Yeah, the tilt-a-whirl or something.
And they spin you around, and you try to get, they try to desensitize your middle ear. I got to do a couple of flights with maintenance flights in the back seat. They put me on drowning to start with, and then you had to prove that you can do it without it. And while they're doing these flights, they're doing aerobatics because they need to test the plane. So anyway. Somewhere in there, I did succeed, obviously. I did eventually adapt.
Okay, yeah.
But somewhere in there, I realized I don't know if I want to be a jet pilot doing all kind of aerobatics like this if I can't handle this. So, there's several of our instructors were helicopter pilots as well, and I just remember talking to another student who was a little further along in the program than me, and he's just a dear friend in the Lord, and he said, you know what, you might want to consider being a helicopter pilot, or, you know, going into, he said, first of all, your demeanor is a lot more like that, you know, you're not this,
what's that mean?
Cocky jerk. like the fighter pilot, that's my opinion, by the way.
That's fine.
Some, you know, they're very full of themselves, right?
Sure, yeah, I've heard stories.
Yeah, but, and that's not true universally, but they just thought that my demeanor might be better in helicopter pilot. So I said, you know what, Lord, is this where you want me to go? Please confirm it. And eventually I finished primary training, and I decided to go the helicopter route. Mm-hmm. And it was a very great career.
Yeah. And I know some of, obviously, your story already, so I know that God used that decision to save lives, right? So, and we'll get to that in a minute. So I think it's pretty cool that even back then, you know, maybe some air sickness is what God used to cause to save a few lives later on.
Right. I mean, it's neat to see, and also it's neat to see sometimes when you have a challenge and it challenges your view of how I want my life to go. Mm-hmm. It's not the end. Mm-hmm. It's just another path.
Yeah. My dad was in the Army, and he was very funny. He had lots of sayings, but he always said that helicopter pilots were always just a little bit off.
Yeah.
So when you said you had the personality for that, it made me wonder, wait a second, are you just a little bit off? And I don't know what they mean by what he meant by that, but because I've only known a couple of
them. Well, the funny thing is, so helicopters, they don't like naturally want to fly. Right.
That he actually said that. He said, as soon as it gets off the ground, that thing's trying to kill you.
It is. It has, counter rotating forces going in play to keep it flying. Mm-hmm. And if something goes wrong, it's not a quick, or it's not like a long, nice glide down like you would have in a regular airplane. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, it could be catastrophic and it could be quick. So,
right.
So yeah, there's a little bit of paranoia. That's the or a little bit of, okay, what's going to go wrong when you fly helicopters?
What makes it so hard to fly helicopters? Isn't it there's something about your hands have to do opposite things? Is that
sort
what
of,
it is?
Sort of like, so your hands and your feet are always engaged.
Okay.
So the way a helicopter flies is the rotor disc, it spins in one direction, and so it produces it basically produces its own airflow over the rotor blade, and that causes lift, which everything, either a wing, a fixed wing, as it flies through the air, produces lift, and that's what overcomes gravity, or the rotor spins and it produces lift and it lifts up. Mm-hmm. But spinning produces torque, and then there's counter torque, right? And so it's laws of physics, and so you have to have anti-torque, which is your other tail rotor, and so you have just have opposite direction forces going all the time.
So that's why in the movies, like when that tail wing goes off, then the whole thing starts
exactly.
to spin.
That's why it spins.
Gives way to its torque, and
exactly.
it just hits the ground. So really, that tail,
the tail is what's stabilizing it,
keeping it going.
That's right.
Straight.
That's right.
Wow, it really is trying to kill you. It's just But it's cool though. I mean, it can do things that obviously other aircraft can't do.
That's right,
and that's important.
Yeah, it sacrifices speed for the ability to do a lot of other things.
Yeah,
hovering is one of them.
Hovering, right, yeah. which will become important in a few minutes when we hear more about the story. So you mentioned that you felt like God was leading you to be a helicopter pilot, and He was confirming that. So you were a Christian in the military, before, or raised?
Very quick background on me. So I was, I grew up in northern New Jersey I guess on my dad's side anyway, Italian immigrants. Mm.
Pasile,
that's right. Okay. I am third generation American. My grandma came to America in 1905 from Italy. So third generation American. I grew up in northern New Jersey. We were a Roman Catholic family. My dad was very devout. And Roman Catholicism can be cultural as well. And there was some sense of that. But there was they have stepping stones in some ways, like Judaism, right? So when you get baptized as a baby, when you're in second grade, you get your first communion. Which is the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, and then by around the teenage years, you get confirmed, which is when you're supposed to be saying, "Hey, I am a believer. Mm-hmm. And so I did all those steps. But to be quite frank, I did not meet Jesus Christ in the Roman Catholic Church. That is nothing against the Roman Catholic Church. Just for me, I did not have that relationship with him. It was very cultural, very, this is what we do on Sundays. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, or Saturday night. In college, so at the Naval Academy, I wandered for a bit. I liked to party. I just did college stuff, sure. You know. But God was not done with me. In spring of 1992, I went to Daytona Beach, Florida on a spring break party time with a couple of buddies. Wendy went down there, my future wife, she went down there as on a beach evangelism trip.
No
with,
way.
Yeah, with wow. InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
Sure. Yeah.
And I met her there. There were some, we did not actually talk about Jesus that week because I really wasn't in the state to to do that. But I was, they were some of the nicest people we met that week.
Yeah.
And when we came back up to I came back to the Naval Academy, and she ended up being at Mary Washington College. I think it's the University of Mary Washington now. Which was neat because it was only about an hour and a half away. So everywhere we could have come from around the United States, we ended up being only an hour and a half away. Yeah. Another little God thing.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to. I wanted to talk to her a little bit more, and so eventually, but I didn't have any of her point of contact information. But a friend of mine, who I went down there with, he had gotten sick of the party scene and had spent some time with them, and he had their contact info. Mm-hmm. And so it ended up being. Eventually I got it through him, and we started talking, and this was the era where email was the newest, biggest thing. So we ended up having an email romance.
Oh, wow.
As it turns out, she had a strong faith in Jesus and was happy to talk about it, and started getting a lot of people praying. She was raised in a Presbyterian home. Her youth pastor at college was a Presbyterian minister, so I was slowly introduced to the doctrines of grace and sola scriptura, and you know all the
solus Christus.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it was not that long. It was only so I met her in spring '92. In August of '92, she had given me a Bible. I remember sitting on a bench at the Naval Academy, and I opened it up to John 3:16, and I. Read, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. And I said, you know, I really believe that.
Yeah.
And I credit that moment kind of as my conversion moment.
Yeah, sure.
The next 3 years were interesting because I ended up trying to reconcile Roman Catholicism with the Protestant doctrines.
Right, yeah.
And talking with a Roman Catholic priest who was the command chaplain of the Naval Academy. Mm-hmm. And started reading the Bible. And so it was a great time of growth. Wendy and I started going forward, dating. We couldn't get married because you can't get married at the Naval Academy. So that gave us plenty of time to figure our relationship out.
Right.
My relationship with Christ. And eventually we ended up getting married in the Protestant Church because I couldn't reconcile everything.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to promise that I would raise kids Catholic. And I was like, I'm sorry, I don't even believe some of this.
Yeah.
So, again, not necessarily a full knock on the Roman Church. It's I know many of a brother and sister who were strong believers, but just doctrinally, I had a hard time with some of it.
That's a pretty amazing story. I guess some evangelistic vacationing and evangelistic dating on Wendy's part. That God used to...
Not recommended.
Yeah, not recommended, but certainly something but certainly God uses. Which is amazing. I mean, and then, so in military isn't really distinct from becoming a Christian or even being a Christian, but really it's kind of intertwined in your story. That
it
is what God has used.
Right, yeah. So early on, I was a believer. So the rest of the time I was at the Naval Academy, I was a believer. I started meeting some friends there who are still brothers today, very good friends today. So yeah, it was good. He was faithful.
Yeah. How did God protect you during this time, either spiritually or even physically while you're in the military? He obviously took care of you.
Right. So yeah, so there's, so as you go through the military, it's, or, you know, the military lifestyle is, it looks glamorous at first, and then there's times when it's just not.
Sure.
You're moving every 3 years, you're uprooting, and then you're having to plug in.
What are some of the places you moved to?
Right, so we moved 12 times.
12 times?
Yeah, within a 28-year career. So the first year of marriage, we moved three times. I was waiting to start flight school, so I was in I was working a job in Washington, D.C. I was living in Arlington. It was somewhere in D.C. And then, so Wendy moved in after we got married, and then we almost immediately moved to Pensacola, Florida. And then there was only 6 weeks of ground school, and I was hoping to get stationed right there in Pensacola. Instead, I got moved out to Corpus Christi. So that was the first year. And so then we went back to Pensacola, then to Jacksonville, then back to Pensacola. So there was a lot of time in Florida in the first about 5 years. Mm-hmm. Thought I was going to get out of the military. So that's an interesting thing right there. I tried to get out of the military four times.
Oh, really?
And God said no every time until the last one.
Huh.
So I guess in some way that's a protective thing, in that he had not, I was not done yet.
He was doing something in you and through you.
Yes, yeah. That was over the 28 years. We moved to Japan twice. We talked about that.
Konnichiwa.
Yeah, it was fantastic, but it was different. Moved to Annapolis again, and then eventually to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where I spent the last 6 years.
Okay.
So
why is there a naval base in the middle of Carlisle, Pennsylvania?
There's not. That's a great question. And no, I was working at the Army War College there.
Oh, yeah.
And they wanted what we call joint warriors, warriors from other services there. So to go back to your original question, how did God protect me? One of the things he did throughout all these moves is everywhere we went, we either found a good church or we found some very good mentors, spiritual mentors. The Navigators are an organization that have a military ministry, and I know about six or seven different navigators or their couple or navigator couples. That we are still in touch with today and mentored me over time, discipled me. So, yeah. And then every time I would go out on a deployment, I did six different deployments over time. Usually during that time, I would have some kind of fellowship, some kind of brotherhood. So, yeah, I was not left all alone to fend myself.
Yeah.
And then just physically, I was very fortunate for most of my career, even during operations and during Iraqi Freedom, I didn't actually have to go into Iraq or into a hot combat zone. So that was a blessing for me.
Yeah, that is. And to your family, too.
Yes.
Yeah, because those are some hot, dangerous places.
Yes.
Yeah, God definitely protected you physically and spiritually, and that's cool. I love that you were able to find churches, mentors, really Christian fellowship, and that's just God's sovereignty. It's part of Christ's kingdom Christ's parable of the kingdom, where it's like leaven just moving out throughout the whole lump of dough, and it's that's how you run into somebody here in Annapolis or somebody there on a beach in Daytona, and that's how God does things, which is. That's just awesome. So, all right. So we keep hinting at it, but let's talk about the big rescue, right? You ended up on TV because something went bad out at sea.
Right.
And by this time you're well into the military. You've been a Navy helo pilot for a number of years. Just
right. Yeah, I'll
give us a brief rundown.
I'll give you a quick
the rescue.
Right. So as we talk about this here, you know, obviously they've got Hurricane Milton bearing down on Florida.
That's right. Yeah.
So go back about 25 years to September of 1999. And it was a similar issue, except that it was Hurricane Floyd, and it was coming on the Atlantic side. And we were a few months from, from deploying for the second time. I was in the Aegis 11 Dragon Slayers at the time. We deployed on aircraft carriers, and we were about to go to the Middle East. And as the hurricane came, they decided to evacuate all the ships out of Mayport, Florida. And usually when a ship goes to sea, it doesn't just go without some kind of search and rescue assets. And so I ended up on that ship along with four other pilots.
What was the carrier?
It was the John F. Kennedy.
Okay.
The old John F. Kennedy.
Okay. Oh, cool.
If you still want to see her, you can see her on the approach to runway 27 at Philadelphia right now.
Okay.
So, while we were out to sea, there was a ship called the Gulf Majesty. It was an ocean-going tugboat, and it was pulling a...
Was this a civilian craft?
Yeah. It was pulling a 750-foot barge, and it was going from Puerto Rico to Jacksonville. Mm. And for some reason, they thought that they could cut across the top of the storm. And unfortunately, the storm changed direction a little bit, and they ended up sinking. Essentially, their engine room started flooding, and it was early in the morning on September 15th, and they called for help.
The old Mayday.
Yeah, it was a Mayday, and so the Coast Guard has satellites and can see things, but they had no assets in the area because they pulled everything off the eastern coast of Florida because of the storm. It's very similar to what's going on right now in, mm-hmm. on the west coast of Florida. So fortunately, we were out there and they asked the Navy if they could intervene. They contacted our ship, the ship contacted us and said, hey, what do you think?
Where were you guys? Where was your, were you at sea or were you in port?
Yeah, we were out at sea because you don't want ships in port.
Right. Or
so we had successfully got out there and evaded the storm. And so the captain and the admiral decided, once they consulted with us and we agreed to do the rescue, to turn the ship around and go back into the storm. Wow. So we, and it was big. It was, the ship lost some of their own life rafts because of the as they were plowing into these seas. And so anyway, it was nasty. Mm-hmm. So what happened was, what we were picking up was called an emergency personnel beacon, radio beacon.
It's like on the vest.
It's actually bigger. It's actually kind of about the size of your
French press here.
Your little French press, yeah. So fortunately, we would be able to radio home in on that. Mm-hmm. And so we were told that there's eight people aboard, that they were abandoning ship into a little raft, and they would have an EPIRB. And so we took off.
I'm sorry, they'll have a what?
The EPIRB, I'm sorry, the emergency beacon.
I heard EBURB.
Yeah, so I was, okay. EPIRB, yeah.
EPIRB.
Emergency personal radio beacon.
Okay,
EPRB.
Good. All
right,
got it.
So we take off into the storm, we go home in on this. They're in the seas now for about 3.5 to 4 hours.
Okay. Thankfully, it's down south, so they're not...
It's warm water. The winds are bad. The seas are bad. And I'm saying bad, like 25 feet. Oh, wow. And so we home in on this beacon. We're a flight of two helicopters. And our lead sees them, and he goes into the hover to pick them up. And what the surprise we got was it was only three guys in the water holding onto a broomstick.
Literally holding onto a broomstick
to keep themselves together. They had levitation, but so they rescue these guys. We search the immediate area, don't find anybody else. Mm-hmm. Return to the carrier. What happened was when they were abandoning ship, the rope that was holding the raft parted. And so five guys were in the water, or five guys had gotten into the raft, and these three that were left watched their salvation go into the wind, and it was gone. And so all they could do was jump in the water, get away from the boat that was sinking.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they had the radio beacon, because otherwise we would never have found those guys. So now we return, and now it's going to be a visual search to find this raft in the afternoon, because there's no way to home in on it. Yeah. So I took on a second or a third crew member, another rescue swimmer, because I wanted more eyes, and we talked to the Coast Guard. They came up with a bunch of models and you know, the input from these people where we picked them up, and so they're trying to figure out seas and winds and where's the best place to locate the place. So they give us some coordinates, and we take off again into the storm. Weather's worse now. A lot of low ceilings, a lot of rain squalls. Seas are getting more like 30 feet.
Oh my. Does the helicopter fly okay in rain?
It's fine. It's got a lot of power, but I mean, we feel like we're cocked into the wind and flying sideways.
Yeah, so you're having to fight with it.
Yeah, it's just weird. It just feels really weird.
Okay.
But we're at least at this point, we're kind of like 500 to 1,000 feet. We're not like right over the water. So eventually we sort of started to take some separation from the lead. So as we ran out of these rain squalls, we didn't want to hit each other. So going around one of these storms, he went one way, I went the other, and I ran into the ship. Really the barge, that it was, the barge did not sink, it just ended up, the ship, the tugboat was like on chains underneath this barge.
And, oh, wow.
And so the barge was a really big find, because now we had something solid, not just these models the SAR, or the Coast Guard sent us. And so we circled the barge, nobody was there. And then I had a big decision to make, whether to search upwind or downwind. And I'm looking for a little raft, and I'm trying to decide whether it blew further than this large 750-foot barge. So
I remember you posing this question to the group that you told this to before, and you said, "Do you think it went upwind or downwind?" And I'm like, "Oh, clearly it went downwind. Clearly."
Right. Yeah, you would have searched in the wrong spot.
They would not be with us today.
No.
Okay.
And so the reason I decided, was it's smaller, it had an anchor out, and it's going up and down these waves, whereas the barge had a much larger square area, and it was just kind of pushing through the waves. So I took a guess, and it was the right call. We ended up doing what we call a ladder search, which is basically going back and forth the track upwind. And that's, I think at that point, that was really where I started praying, because I'm like, "God, we're here." It was getting later in the day. The weather was getting worse. This is going to probably be the last flight of the day.
Running out of fuel, maybe?
Running out of daylight. I was like, "You know what? God, we could really use some help here."
Right.
And so about 40 minutes into that search pattern, we finally flew right on top of them.
Wow.
And
what did that feel like? I mean,
it was relief.
Okay.
For me, except that now we had to actually do the
rescue. Now you actually have to see. Yeah, you're not just saying.
We did the search part. Now we got to do the rescue.
That must have been like treasure hunting, and just like you found what you're looking for.
Right, and it was really neat, because it was like in one of those moments we were going through a squall, and it was if you ever gone through a car wash where you're looking at the windscreen as the water's coming over, as the machine's washing your car. I mean, that's what it was like. It was like,
and you spotted them visually.
Right, yeah, but we were looking down.
Sure.
And so fortunately we found them.
Wow.
And so then I got into the hover. It took me a while to figure out how to work, because the autopilot wasn't working. So we ended up, because of the seas, the way that our systems work, it just wasn't built to hover there.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing a high hover and just holding it, and we sent the rescue swimmers down. First one got one guy out, ended up aspirating a whole bunch of water because he got yanked off the raft, and we got him up. That was a good deal that I brought a second swimmer because he was able to do the other four.
Yeah. Wow.
Those guys.
So the swimmer aspirated the
water. Yeah, he ended up, okay. Yeah, the first time.
Wow. Oh
so the really neat thing was, like, you know, I told you before, like, the pilots were cocky, you know, that we got nothing on those swimmers. I mean, those guys were brave.
There's these, oh, sure, these, they're dropping into 30
these young,
seas.
Yeah, these young kids, like 20-something-year-olds, in some ways they're too dumb to be scared. You know?
That's fair, yeah.
But, yeah, they were strong swimmers. They went through a great rescue swimmers course. And but a lot of them were just like, this was their first rescue. And I'm like, it's all downhill
here. Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, we rescued all five, wow. Brought them all up, and returned to the carrier. And I said during my talk, like, you know, that's a neat story, but God is the one who really brought all that out.
Of course.
Right? I mean, the fact that we just happened to be out there, you know, carrier just happened to be out there with the right assets to be able to do that. People who've been training for years to be able to do that mission.
I mean, even going back to what we said earlier, I mean, you're getting airsick is one of the things that God used to rescue these five guys.
Right. Like,
and I think that's one of the neat things about Christian theology and our belief system, you know, that we know to be true, both from the Word of God and experientially, is that sometimes we get to look back and see all the different steps that God used. You know, one day we'll know that fully in heaven, but with Him. But I think it's neat to be able to look back and say all of these different steps God used out in the middle of the ocean to rescue five guys that had no other hope. Well, eight, because the broomstick guys,
right,
too.
The broomstick guy, yeah.
Just amazing.
Yeah, I like to say that there's just, like, there's no accidents there, right? I mean, it's just amazing. Like, he was working days, weeks, years, decades before that to make that event happen.
Yeah.
So it's kind of neat to be able to look back and see that.
Yeah. So you ended up on Dateline or something. Was it Dateline or what was the show? 2020?
No, it was Dateline. Yeah.
Oh, Dateline.
So
okay.
It was NBC. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But yeah. So we ended up there. Yeah. We
those are cool.
Yeah. For a little while, we were heroes, right?
Yeah. But, still are, especially to those five guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you keep in touch with any of them at all?
I've kind of lost track, and yeah, that's another neat thing to say. Like, you know, we gave them back their lives. What do they do with their lives?
Yeah.
You know? But Wendy put the a video on YouTube, I think, and recently she's got a couple of comments from not the survivors, but maybe some of their family members.
Sure.
So that's kind of
That's neat. Yeah. I'm sure it's a hard thing for the survivors to even think about, right? So it's not like they're just, you know, calling you up every day. You know,
oh, no.
Every survivor has a different way they deal with things, but. It's still pretty cool that God used you to.
It was really neat.
That's awesome.
It was really neat.
Well, so then you transitioned from that in the military to working in civilian life as an airline pilot.
I did.
Right? So I wouldn't say you're saving lives every day, but you're certainly keeping lives alive every day as we, you know, hurtle through the air at 35,000 feet and go from point A to point B. But was that a hard transition to, I mean, from civilian life to, or from military life to civilian life, or, you know, Navy to airline?
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, you do something for 28 years.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's the ending of one era and the start of something else. And so I guess I'll take this just this moment to say, you know, God is sovereign. My life verse is Proverbs 3:5-6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding, and all your ways acknowledge Him. He will direct your paths. Right. Mm-hmm. So I told you I tried to get out of the military a few times. Mm-hmm. One of them was after that hurricane rescue. I went to the training command. I flew the primary aircraft that we flew. We got a lot of flight hours, so that's what helped me eventually make this transition to the airline. But I was thinking about doing something there, the reserves or whatnot, and then 9/11 happened, and everything just shut down. And I was still allowed to get out if I wanted to, but just something at the time, you know, God just kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, yeah, not yet.
Mm-hmm. So still more for you.
So I re-upped and went another, I went another many years until my 20-year mark. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to get out again. And this was like 2013 now. And I was on the cusp of starting to look at airline jobs and other kind of jobs. And again, I just got a kind of check in the spirit, like, this is not yet. Mm. And so stayed in, went to Japan the second time. It was fantastic.
What was life in Japan like?
So Japan's a really neat culture. We really enjoyed it. I'm really glad we got to go twice. The first time we were in Yokosuka, which is close to Tokyo on the island of Honshu.
Okay.
The second time we were in Sasebo, which is on the island of Kyoto, way out on the west. And it was sort of like a city, living in an urban area versus living in a rural area.
Okay. And your kids were with you, or right. They were still in the house at the time, right?
They were.
How old were they?
Right. So the first time they were young.
Yeah.
I had... like 5'3" and 1.5" or something. Wow. Like, I mean, they were young. And then the second time they were all teenagers or about to leave. So it was kind of neat for them to see it two different time periods. Like I said, the culture's really neat. Spiritually, it is a very dark place. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ancestor worship, Hinduism, Buddhism. They'll talk a little bit spiritually about spiritual matters, but Christianity is a hard inroad mm-hmm. there in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We did get to go to a Christian mission church there, which was kind of neat. So that was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And the pastor actually spoke Japanese and English, so but he did the sermon in English, and then they translated it to Japanese, which was kind of neat.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was neat. We had a family friend. Her name was Nordico. I still pray for her.
Mm.
She really made that second tour really kind of neat. Just cultural exchange. She showed us how to use the bus system. We went on vacation with us at one point.
Fun.
And we did. We just, I do not know where she is spiritually, but she was neat.
Yeah, keep praying.
Yeah.
Remember, God uses all those things. And
yeah.
In his way and his
does.
Plan. Did you pick up any Japanese
words?
Cultural? Japanese words. Yeah. Besides
skoshi.
What's that mean?
It's a little.
Oh, a little. Okay. I wonder if that's where we get our word skosh.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Maybe.
No, I like favorite foods, different things like that. I know when I lived in China for a while, and picked up some favorite foods and different cultural things I liked. But sushi lover.
I never became a sushi
ramen,
lover.
Maybe.
Yeah, some ramen. Yeah, ramen was really neat.
Yeah.
But never got into sushi.
Yeah.
I did watch a friend try to eat some blowfish. And he did not
did
die.
Did he do okay?
He
all
did
right.
not die. He did get. He did say it felt very tingly afterwards. I'm like,
not a smart move.
You're crazy, man.
Yeah, I draw the line at blowfish.
Yeah, apparently, I mean, it was a restaurant, world famous restaurant. He's like, I can't do it here. I'm not gonna be able to do it anywhere. I'm like,
I don't think you need to do it anywhere.
Exactly. Blowfish is toxic.
Yeah. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah. Whatever. So to answer your question,
right.
though, so eventually we got, coming back from Japan, we got orders to the Army War College. So, and that was a really neat tour. So I kind of had a pretty good clue at this point that I was at my terminal rank and I wasn't going to really go for any further.
Which was?
I was a Navy captain.
Navy captain.
Which is like a colonel in the Air Force and Army.
Okay.
It's one rank below admiral, so I wasn't going to make admiral. I wasn't going to get any more like command tours or anything like that.
Right.
So I said, I don't want to be in the Pentagon rowing hard, showing you when the chair gets pulled out and that's it. You know, the music stops. There's no more chair for me.
Right.
So. I decided to go teach at the Army War College. They gave me a choice between that and Navy, which is Newport, Rhode Island. I'm not a big New England fan. Also, just driving-wise, it would be easier to go see my family in Northern New Jersey and Wendy's family in Virginia. So that's why we chose Pennsylvania. It was a three-year tour, and I started looking at my exit strategy at that point.
Okay.
And... So as I began to teach, I enjoyed it. I taught military strategy. We had a class of 400 people. And we would break them into like 20 different seminars of about 15 or so, whatever the math is. And then, it was a traditional school year. So it was great. We teach for the year, and you didn't even teach the whole year because we had certain months that we were on the pulpit, or the podium. We call it the podium.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The church calls it the pulpit. Gotcha.
But anyway, what I began to realize was they wanted me there for I was called a practitioner. Okay. I was practicing all of these things that we were teaching.
Okay.
But I wasn't an academic, and I realized early on I didn't want to stay in academia. Mm-hmm. If I had stayed, because I could have stayed, I could have gotten out, stayed there, become like an associate professor or something, but then I would have had to start writing and researching. Mm-hmm. And I realized I'm not
publish or perish.
Yeah, I'm just not really that kind of person. So sure. By this time I had not flown for about 10 years, but I wanted to get back into it. I really enjoyed it. And so I started looking at...
Did you have to keep like your certifications up? Did you like...
I had to get back to that, right?
Okay, so yes. You really hadn't been off the ground flying for...
Right. My last flying tour was before Japan, right? Wow. So in 2013, and now we're talking like 2017, I came back from Japan and started teaching at the War College.
Did you miss it during that time? Did you like, man, I'm just itching to fly?
I did.
Like, woo, I don't have to fly.
No, I did. Man. I missed it.
Yeah.
So that was something that God kind of revealed to me that, hey, I put this love in you for a reason. And so I decided I wanted to fly. And then it was, okay, well, what kind of flying? Do I want to go into airline jobs? Do I want to go into helicopter jobs? And I said, you know what? I always wanted to be a jet pilot.
Maybe my stomach settled down right now.
I'm not going to be doing aerobatics.
Yeah, let's hope not. I don't know. I've been on some flights.
In a 7-3, right? Yeah. I just started working to get recurrent again, to do some flying. Mm-hmm. So is the transition hard? I think you asked that question. So I will say this, that learning to fly a modern airliner from my background was a little bit challenging.
Yeah.
It would be like using a 1990s flip phone and now all of a sudden having to learn how to use iPhone, right?
Interesting.
So it's just a lot of new technology for me.
And if I may, and I know I'm ignorant, but a helicopter pilot, there's a lot of tactile things, right? I mean, you're feeling what the bird is doing or whatever you call it.
Right. You never take your hands and feet off the controls.
Off the controls, right? Because you're feeling the air movement.
You're
just pushing buttons.
These airliners are very highly automated. Okay. They have fantastic autopilots.
Yeah.
And just the screens in front of you is like playing a video game. We call it a glass cockpit.
Oh.
And the last plane I flew, it had what we call steam dials, right? These just little almost like analog
things, yeah.
Right? Okay. So, so there was a little bit of that. The other interesting thing was when I went to, I got hired by Republic and I went to their training. And everybody in my class is about half my age, right? I mean, they're like, it's like flying with my son at this point.
Right.
So it was just, it was just a different time period. The other thing that was a little hard on the transition was just, we just took a lot of change at once. So that's another interesting thing for God. I told you I tried to get out four times. Mm-hmm. In 2000, I had a class date of May 2020. Which is, of course, right smack in the middle of COVID.
Right in the middle of it, yeah.
And so the airlines had stopped hiring. And so God took care of us. Since I was like one of the lone Navy people at an Army War College, and Navy wasn't too keen in sending people there, they were more than happy to extend me for the amount of time I needed to be there. So I just kept extending until they hired again. And so May 2022, I took the... April 2022, I retired, mm-hmm. I did a retirement ceremony. I started training in May of 2022. Official retirement date was August of 2022. We went retirement after 28 years, took a new job, went empty nest and made a move to Indiana.
Yeah, that's
which I've never been here before.
You just moved to Indiana.
Yeah. So
welcome to the Midwest.
Yes. Oh. Yeah, it's great. And so yeah, we're really enjoying being here. And then we did one more move because we decided we would move to an apartment to make sure that I did like the job, we did like the area.
Makes sense.
And we did. And so after that year, we bought a townhome over on Aurora Road, and, right on the Monon, and that's where we are today.
That's cool.
Yeah. Wow.
All right, so God is using you now to get people from A to B, right?
I mean, yes.
How do you, what's your take? You know, because it's sometimes easier to connect the dots between being a helicopter pilot and saving these people that are at sea, right? And God's using me to do that. But it might be a little more discreet, a little harder to see how God's using you now. But what are your thoughts on your role as a Christian in the airline industry?
Right. So, you know, what's really neat is, I can't remember where it is in Ephesians, but it says he gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, and some to be pastors and teachers to prepare God's people for works of service, so the body of Christ might be built up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not an apostle, and I'm not a prophet.
Me neither.
I'm not a prophet, although I do like to tell the truth. I feel like I'm a bit of an evangelist and also a disciple maker.
Yeah.
So while I was 6 years at the Army War College, I met my last navigator that I really got close with, and I got into disciple making. So every year, we would invite people at the beginning of the year to join a program called Every Man a Warrior. And it's a men's discipleship program that runs about 9 months. And I really found that I enjoyed that. So that's one thing I'd like to get back into. The second thing is the airline business is a very people-oriented business. And people, men in particular, unless you're sort of bent that way, don't just sort of like go up to strangers and start telling them about the gospel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is, every trip I do is an opportunity to meet three new people in my crew, and then who knows how many people, you know, we fly around. So I do 3-day trips. I'm usually stuck in a non-cubic foot area with somebody for 3 days, not necessarily all 3 days,
right,
coming and going. So every time I go, I say, I ask God to make me a sower in some way, shape, or form. Whoever I'm meeting today, whatever they need, give me wisdom on what to say or what not to say. Sometimes it's just about listening. And it's been neat. It's been really neat to see, to be able to sow sometimes, to have sometimes very spiritually rich conversations, and sometimes just to not, you know. Sometimes it's just give some life advice. A lot of the captains I fly with, they are 40s and 50s, so, and they're like ecstatic after they learn about me a few minutes, and oh my gosh, you're not like a 25-year-old kid.
You can actually do something if this plane starts to go down.
Not only that, it's just there's some good advice. Like I can give you some good advice. Yeah. I've got three adult children now, and you know I've lived through two parents dying, and you know, and there's just I've had some great conversations folks that I can just give some biblical advice. Sometimes I name it biblically, and sometimes I don't, because it's not gonna go over well with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still wisdom from God. And so that's what I really am enjoying.
That's neat.
It's a nice semi-retirement kind or second career kind of job.
Yeah.
I'm not killing myself trying to make a lot of money or anything like that. I'm very fortunate, I don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
I can just be used in a way to interact with people and tell them about the hope of Christ. Politics, for example, the what Pastor Josiah said the other, you know, two Sundays ago about, hey, where is your hope?
Mm.
Seems to be a very popular topic these days.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get in the plane, and for some reason, people want to talk about politics. Of course, it's election year, right? Mm-hmm. And more often than not, I will just say my hope is not politics.
Yeah,
you know, it's in God. So
that's great.
So yeah, that's where I feel like I guess I'm trying to do what Wendy did with me so long ago, mm-hmm. right? Is
that's cool.
To save souls. I'm not saving lives necessarily using that being a helicopter anymore, but now I'm sowing and. I may not see the reaping on this side of heaven, but eventually I will.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you for taking that perspective, and it's super cool to hear how you connected that to Wendy's work, you know, as a vacationer evangelist and in the beach, and then seeing that, you know, God's using you in that way as well. That's just really encouraging. In a small way, you have a ministry to some of us that really like United Wipes. for our listeners, I actually have one with me here. I happen to have one in my back pocket. United Wipes are by far the best sanitizing wipes out there.
They are
fantastic to wipe your hands with, wipe your face, whatever you need. We were on a mission trip together, and I took a soccer ball to the face in this ghetto, and the soccer ball was all over all sorts of trash and sludge, and it just face planted, and I'm a germaphobe. And so my first response probably should have been more spiritual, like, praise the Lord, I'm willing, I can suffer for Jesus or whatever. But my first response was, does anybody have a United Wipe? And I think in your laughter, eventually you found one in your bag.
We found one for you eventually.
Yeah. And I was
able to have it.
Calm me down.
Yes.
But you get United Wipes because Republic co-chairs or something.
Co-chairs. Well, we fly with United, and so I could pick some up sometimes.
And pick some up, every once in a while, and drop some off. So that, you know, in a small way, that's a ministry.
There you go.
God's using you to keep me clean, I guess.
Yes. I'm going to have to come back out to Colorado Springs and bring some to you.
Please do. You're always welcome. That's awesome. We're going to wind it up, but you brought some things. I'm curious about them.
Oh, it's just some coins. Things. Yeah,
I'm guessing from the Navy.
Yeah, so these are called challenge coins, and the idea of challenge coins is started like when they used to have officer clubs and enlisted clubs. And if you came into a club and somebody challenged you and wanted to see your coin, you had to show it to them, otherwise you bought the round. But they really kind of have evolved to different commands, or different officers making their own coins, and it sort of like shows off the pride of the So the ones I have here is HS-11, which is the squadron I was in during the hurricane rescue, and closely linked to it,
that's the Dragon Slayer.
Yes, the Dragon Slayer.
I don't know if this will come up on the camera.
This one is presented by Admiral Jay Johnson. So during the aftermath of the rescue, we did get some medals for our heroism. And
as you should.
And that Admiral, who was the Chief of Naval Operations at the time, he presented that one to me. This was my command tour. I was a commanding officer of Helicopter Training Squadron 28. And we were, ironically, the Hellions.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So that one's kind of neat there. And then lastly, this was just really neat. I was on the USS Enterprise in 2007, which is...
the one that's like out in outer space?
It was the first nuclear carrier. And so we, at the end of our cruise, we were able to do a Tiger cruise, which means we were able to bring dependents aboard. And so this is my daughter, Kate.
Oh, neat.
She was 10
years
old.
She was able to see what Dad did.
She was able to come and
take
a couple of days, pretty much.
On the Enterprise?
On the Enterprise itself.
Wow. Do you remember what year that was built, the Enterprise?
I think it was like 1955 or something like that.
It was a nuclear aircraft carrier.
Yeah, or somewhere, or maybe the 60s. But it was somewhere between there, and it went all the way to 2012.
Wow.
And so there's generations of sailors who have been on that carrier.
Wow.
Was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, those were just a few.
I don't think
things.
It was nuclear back then.
It was.
Sorry for my ignorance, but I didn't know that we were powering naval vessels.
Yeah, that was the first naval ship, and they had like 8 reactors on there. Most today only have 2. You don't need 8, but they didn't know any better. So, but she went. Yeah, she made it all the way for many, many years.
Yeah, many decades.
So, yeah.
Wow. Sounds awesome.
It was a cool ship.
Well, Chris, thank you for being here. This was a delight to hear your story again. I know this is the second time I've heard it, and I'm just super encouraged with what God's doing, you know, what he did in your life and then what he continues to do, and what I'm confident that he will keep doing as you're a pilot, but also as a disciple maker. So just keep up the great work, and you know, keep up the United Wipes coming my way.
I will, and I'm going to say for you, congratulations on your...
Oh, thank you. Yes, a different position, new position.
Yeah, your new position.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
We're going to miss you.
Yeah, well, likewise. It's bittersweet for sure, but I'm super grateful for all that God has done and getting to know people like you. And I'm convinced those types of relationships continue over time and distance.
They do. Yeah. I can testify to that.
You can vouch for that being in the military.
Yeah, being in the military.
Yeah. So. Awesome. Well, thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And this is a United Wipe, which is 70% isopropyl alcohol and single use only, but sometimes I squeeze a couple uses out of it, you know, pre-meal, after meal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by...
This episode is brought to you by United and Republic and all those things.
All right.
Oh, that's fun stuff.
Maine and Gray is brought to you by Christ Community Church of Carmel, Indiana, at the corner of Main Street and Gray Road. If you're looking for a church home or just visiting the Indianapolis area, stop in and say hi. We'd love to get to know you. Until then, God bless.